Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's Reagan Forum, we go back a few weeks to our virtual program with New York Times bestselling author Marcus Brotherton. Marcus previously joined us a year ago on Memorial Day 2021 and is back for his latest book, A Bright and Blinding Sun, a World War II story of survival, love, and redemption. We invited Marcus to share his book with our audience as part of our programming surrounding our new special exhibition at the Reagan Library, The Secrets of World War II. Marcus is best known for his books with high-profile figures, humanitarians, inspirational leaders, and military personnel. His works include books with the elite World War II paratroopers, featured in HBO's Band of Brothers, and the elite World War II Marines, featured in HBO's The Pacific. He also co-wrote Gary Sinise's autobiography, Grateful American. During today's program, Marcus sat down in conversation with Reagan Foundation and Institute Chief Marketing Officer Melissa Giller to discuss A Bright and Blinding Sun, the incredible true war story of an underage soldier, only 14 years old, who experiences his first love and loss on the battlefields of Bataan and Corridor. This lyrically written and deeply encouraging saga will remind you that every life can be lifted, forgiveness is the patron of restoration, and redemption is available to all. Let's listen.
Thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate having you here. I got your book last week. I had to take a flight from LA to DC, 5.5 hours, and the next thing I knew, your book was done. I wanted it to keep going, so an amazing read. I'm gonna actually start by reading my note card because your bio on your website said something very specific that I liked. It said, you are dedicated to writing books that inspire heroics, promote empathy, and encourage noble living. So when you became an author, what made you decide to go down that path?
Yeah, there's got to be a purpose behind what we write. And, you know, there's more to life than just, you know, rocks and trees and breakfast cereal and things like that. And so it's this everyday heroics. Every person can live for something that matters. And that's what I really wanted to service and bring to the table.
So my favorite type of book, whether I should admit it or not, is historical fiction. But you're really writing historical nonfiction and turning that into a novel instead of a textbook. I would have to think that's so much harder to write. What's your process?
Yeah, so I've done any number of nonfiction books, and then I've done one novel in contrast. And I love nonfiction. I love fiction as well, but nonfiction to truly bring up something that happened in history and then surface that for the reader. There is a sense where nonfiction, I think, needs to be, you know, massaged into a three-act structure. History needs to be informative and inspiring and yet also entertaining, because there's just so many options out there for people today. So I do try and have that entertainment factor in all my books.
Well, you've clearly hit it. That's a great description of it. Now, this is our second Memorial Day in a row at the Reagan Library, where our event is you. Last year, you joined us for a virtual program on your book on Medal of Honor recipient Gary Bykirk. Now, of course, you're here with us to talk about your book on World War II veteran Joe Johnson Jr. And again, you're telling these stories, you're bringing history to light, you're making them entertaining, but how are you choosing your actual subjects?
Well, and just pausing for a moment to remember Gary Bykirk, Blaze of Light, the last book I did. He actually passed away this December. Just a remarkable man. He died of cancer before his time, but we just honor him and celebrate his life for sure. You know, like Gary, Joe Johnson struck me immediately as just a likable guy, and not only likable, but somebody who's having lived a remarkable story, ultimately that contributes to our freedom. It was funny when the Joe, he had actually written two different memoirs in his life, and one he had independently published, and as the story goes, he had sold a few hundred copies out of his garage. Now, I happen to love obscure World War II manuscripts. Just the kind of the more rare it is, the better it is. So when COVID started, I had gathered a stack of these manuscripts to read. Joe Johnson's first memoir was way down in the stack. It caught my eye. I read it and kind of same thing, you know, overnight. I went, wow, this is amazing. He had passed away in 2017 at age 91. So I reached out to his family and just to convey my thanks and sort of my awe and wow, what a tremendous story and life that he's lived. To my surprise, they responded very quickly and they said, you know, we recognize your name. You've written some books. We would love if Joe Johnson's story, you know, sort of got out of the garage sale category and reached a broader audience. It's just so good. It has to be done. And so that began this conversation that ultimately led to this book.
So when I was doing some research preparing for this conversation, I came across his family has a Facebook page in memory of Joe Johnson Jr. And it talks just about that and talks about being connected with you. It talks about his book, Baby of Bataan, I believe was his actual biography. And so you mentioned that you found it while reading obscure books during COVID. So without giving too much away, have you found your next subject in that stack of books?
Well, we're talking. I never give too much away this side of things, but yeah, there's any number of projects in the pipeline.
Sure. So you mentioned just a moment ago, of course, that sadly Gary Bykirk passed away from cancer, but he was alive when you wrote his book. So you were able to sit down with him for countless hours and interview him about his own book, whereas for Joe Johnson Jr., you were interviewing his family. On the one hand, I would think it'd be easier if the subject is alive, but on the other hand, it might be harder because if the subject is alive, you're trying to live up to what they're going to ultimately read. How is that alive versus family and writing the two different types of books?
Gary Bykirk became a genuine friend over the course of the 2 years it took to write his book. And we had him over to the house. He met my children. You know, it was just a really wonderful experience meeting this Medal of Honor recipient. Joe Johnson had passed. And so how do you write a book when the man there isn't there? Fortunately, Joe had left behind this wealth of information. He had left his initial memoir that he published. And then there was a very obscure manuscript that even the estate didn't have it. It was just so rare. I was able to track that down. And strangely enough, Joe had written these two different accounts of his life. They were very similar, but there were some differences, which was quite interesting to me. One of the manuscripts he had written in first person voice, I did this, I did that. Another of the manuscripts he had written in third person voice about himself. Joe did this, Joe did that. And that was a very interesting dynamic right there, where it was kind of like the third person voice was actually the first manuscript he had written. And I think that it was kind of so horrific an event that he had trouble entering into the process initially himself, not remembering, but just going to those dark places. And then sort of when he had gotten that out on paper, then he was able to separate himself and write the first person account. In addition to those two manuscripts, he had left behind just this wealth of information, boxes of files, journals, writings. He was a poet. And this just amazed me that this warrior was just with a seventh grade education, was just so lyrical in how he expressed himself. Photos, some taped interviews he had done, some videotaped interviews he had done. And then there was a dozen family members as well that I could interview them and close friends of Joe's, people who knew him very well at various stages of his life. So coupled with this, fortunately, this era in history has just been so robustly documented that we were able to check everything and double check everything. And after action reports with the military confirmed that, yes, everything did take place. And this is fact. It's all went down as it all went down.
So one of the reasons why we connected with you, obviously we follow you, but we have an exhibit right now called The Secrets of World War II, and it's a 10,000 square foot exhibition all about the stories of World War II, some known stories, some unknown stories. And so when we saw that you had a book specifically about a World War II veteran, we wanted to connect with you. And in putting the exhibit together, we were fortunate enough to actually be able to interview in person six World War II veterans. Now, of course, there aren't very many of them alive. They're 96, 97, 98 years old. I have to think there weren't too many alive from Joe Johnson's era. Were you able to speak to any of his fellow brothers in arms?
I read their accounts. Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And thank you, you know, to the Reagan Foundation for doing this. During World War II, there are 16 million Americans who've been enlisted or drafted and somehow serve the country, serve the world, really, in that capacity. From that 16 million, stats say that we have just over 200,000 left. So it really is that whole, the entire generation is passing away. And it's imperative that we not only record their stories, but bring them up again and surface them and you know, help people remember truly what went on in that era.
Yeah. So my last question before we actually get into the book, can you explain your overall process? I mean, how long does it take you from the conception of the idea of who you want to write about or what you want to write about, all the hours of interviews or research, but, then turning in the manuscript, editing the manuscript, and actually getting published? I would have to think is a huge chunk of time. How does that work for you?
It's about a 2-year process, yeah. And the book writing process comes in chunks. It's finding the subject matter and securing that and getting the contracts in place and then preparing this proposal that we take to a publisher, first to an agent and who shops it to various publishers. And then it's the interviewing, researching process. I do have two research assistants who I worked with on this book who are very good. One was actually had lived in the Philippines for a while, and so he was able just to bring that sense of authenticity to that portion of the book. Once the actual manuscript is done, then it goes through any number of other stages at the publishers. They're all triple checking things, and it goes through copy editors and proofreaders and whatnot. When the book is actually done, it gets sold into various outlets who do the retail selling. And then you wait sort of on pins and needles, and then, boy, you just bring that 5 loaves and 2 fish to the table and just hope it gets, you know, multiplied from there.
So your book, you wrote the book in third person, you're telling Joe's story, but you start each section in Joe's voice. What made you do that?
I feel it's very, very important to bring readers to the veterans themselves as much as possible. I love that process of, like, kind of when I get out of the way and readers can sit down, it's kind of like you're sitting on this front porch, you know, sipping on some iced tea and listening to the veteran tell stories of what actually happened. And so because Joe had written these two different manuscripts in the first person and third person, I wanted to bring that to the table as well. I did want to tell his life story as it happened to him, but I also wanted to bring the reader to Joe directly and let them hear from him. So that's the first person is just Joe, and he was crusty to the end, as he noticed reading the book, but man, what a wonderful guy and full heart all the way.
So the book starts, and he's in second grade, and he has to recite a poem in front of the whole class and in front of parents. And he gets to the front of the classroom, and stage fright overtakes him to the point where he can't even get his words out. And the teacher basically has to excuse him, and he sits down. And as he sits down, you know, second grade year old Joe Johnson, I mean, how old are you, tells himself that he will never again give in to fear. And that seemed to set his entire life. Now, again, I'm simplifying his story to the point of beyond simplification, but you know it. 12, he leaves his home, he jumps on a boxcar, he travels all the way to Texas, he finds his father at 14, he joins the military. You know, things that are just a 12 to 14 year old kid does not do. When you were interviewing all these different family members and friends, did anyone ever really get at how the second grade version of himself really changed the course of his whole life?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that story. It's that was one of the lost stories that we surfaced in this book. And fascinating story. I mean, here is this little 7-year-old guy, second grade at Christine Elementary School in Memphis. And you can picture it. It's this event where all the students have been instructed to write their own poem. And then they brought in teachers and grandparents and aunts and uncles. And the child has to read their poem in front of the classroom. So Joe gets up there, and his mother's there, and an aunt is there, and it's sort of a full class, all eyes are on him. And he's shaking so badly that all he can get out is this first line. His poem is called The Little Bird. And he goes, "Once there was a little bird," and he stops. And these seconds just sort of tick by like forever, and everyone's tapping their foot and kind of, you know, nervous in the room. And finally, the teacher gives him this prompt, and she says, "And what was the little bird doing, dear?" And Joe, he can't think of anything. He just sort of blurts it out. "He was just walking down the road, just walking down the road." Of course, the whole class just erupts in laughter. And Joe is crushed. He can't go anywhere further. He hangs his head and he goes and he sits down. But this resolve, this all-important resolve, begins to form in his heart: never again give in to fear. I think it's just this tremendous application for all of us. Definitely Joe lived this way throughout his life, coming back to this again and again. If I'm going to leave home, if I'm going to join the military, if I'm going to face my worst enemy, whatever it's going to be, I am not going to give in to fear. You know, when I was in college, a friend of mine and I, we had this little saying: do what you fear the most. And we decided to live by that motto. And it wasn't so much about, you know, going parachuting or, you know, jumping off a cliff, even though that happened to a certain degree in both of our lives. It was about, you know, there's a good opportunity. Life offers up really good opportunities, many of them. And yet so many of these opportunities get waylaid because we give into fear. Whether it's going to get a degree or moving to another city or taking a job that's kind of a little bit above us, or you know, if you're single, calling up that special someone and asking them out cold for a date. And so never give in to fear. Do what you fear the most. This is a pretty good way to live life. Why? Because it takes you to that opportunity. It takes you through the opportunity and through the open door.
Right. Well, and that memory was so ingrained in his head that I can't remember if I read it in your book or in one of the things I read online, but when he did self-publish his memoir, he wanted to call it Little Bird Walking, and then they convinced him to change the title. So, I mean, that was just with him his whole life. So he joins the military. He's 14 years old. He tells the recruiter that he's 18. He gets in, bizarrely, and he has a really hard life in the military. It's no walk in the park. And at 15, he's really badly injured. He's taken to the hospital, and his friend, brother, you know, fellow platoon guy, tells the doctor, you know, "Joe's only 15. Send him home." And Joe's like, "Oh no. Isn't he funny? I'm really 18." Why did he not take him up on that? And after, you know, after being so, you know, I think it was when all the bamboo was sticking out of his body. You know, why did he not take the out? Why did he stay in the military?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. At that point, really, it was going to be difficult for him to be sent home. The war had started by then. The shipping traffic to and from the Philippines from the States had virtually ceased. And so what am I going to do? They're going to lock me up in the brig because I've lied about my age, or I can keep doing my job. It's a fascinating way, sort of all the way through, where Joe makes sort of a series of decisions as a young man. And many of his decisions are pretty innocent decisions, and yet they lead him further and further and further along this path. He joins the military really to escape a difficult home life. His father has left the family. Joe is kind of the man of the family. At that point, he's caring for his younger siblings. His mother takes up with another man, and it's during the Depression era before the war has begun, and this other man can't find a job, and so he's kind of lounging around on the couch all day. And so Joe finds himself, you know, further pressured, and he's like, you know, maybe my family would be just better off if I got out of here and they could figure things out. So he takes off, leaves Memphis for Texas, where he finds his father. And it's kind of a wonderful reunion there for a little bit. And then things get difficult with his father, and they move to California. And his father gives him this ultimatum: "Look, you know, you can do this, you can do that, you can do that. I really don't care, but you can't stay here." And Joe's like, "Okay, I'm on my own. What am I going to do? I'm going to join the Army." And in Joe's innocent thinking, again, this is before Pearl Harbor. And so he's thinking, well, you know, they need warm bodies, and I'm a hardworking kid, and how hard can it be? And so he goes down to the recruiter's office and says, "Oh yeah, I'm 18, and kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And sure enough, he's in. And suddenly he's entered this world of grown-ups, this world of adults. And he should be sort of, you know, going off to his freshman prom with a date. And yet he's, you know, going through boot camp with these grown men. And then he finds himself sent to the Philippines, and then war breaks out, and it's one thing after another. And he's suddenly in this world for which he is not prepared. And again, he's got to live by that resolve, never again give in to fear.
So, as you said, you know, he's in the military. You know, my previous question was, why did he not tell the doctor he was 15? But then, not that much longer after that, he actually decides he's done. He's had enough. He's seen enough. It's harder than he thought it was going to be. He's seeing death, and he actually writes his mother, begging her to send in his birth certificate to prove that he's only 15 so he can go home. He thinks she never writes. We find out later in the book that she did write, but she did not send the birth certificate, so his letter got stuck. Do we know why she didn't send the birth certificate?
She's a very interesting character, and throughout the whole process of researching and writing the book, I was really trying to figure her out. I think it's definitely a different generation. And I was born in 1968, and I grew up, and as a kid, you know, my mother would have no problem sending me out to play for hours upon hours by myself, or sending me to do an errand that today would be considered fairly grown up. You know, go talk to this person, or go take the bus downtown, or whatever it's going to be. So I think there's definitely some of that going on. It's just a different era. And well, my son is you know, clothed and fed and doing some purposeful work. So that's probably better than what's happening at home. That's what the mother is thinking. It's also just a different era in terms of getting documentation. I mean, there's, you know, it's before the days of the internet, obviously, and getting a birth certificate is no easy thing, particularly because Joe actually wasn't born in Memphis, where his mother lives. And that was part of his fib that he told the recruiter, oh yeah, I was born in Memphis. Actually, he was born in Louisiana and moved to Memphis as a toddler. And so, you know, for Joe's mother living in Memphis, trying to track down that birth certificate, not the easiest thing. And then who knows exactly what was going on in her mind? It's difficult to say. I think that she was in some ways proud of him for doing this manly job and for even being a part of the war effort. It's like there was that response from the general population in America at that time. Like, we've got a job to do. Our country has been attacked. This is after Pearl Harbor. And somebody's got to protect our borders. Well, my son is part of that. Fantastic. Definitely Joe's father, when he finds out that his son has joined the military, his first response is to sign up himself. He's going to enlist as well. We've all got to, you know, serve the cause here for the duration.
Yeah, so again, I don't mean to repeat myself, but it's crazy to think that he was 14, 15, 16 years old when all of this was going on. And he was fortunate to have two other soldiers who clearly knew he was as young as he was, even though he never admitted it to him at the time, Ray and Dale, who really took him under his wing, protected him, and just, you know, made sure he was taken care of. Over the course of the war, they're both killed in action. How do you think that impacted Joe?
Yeah, certainly it's his first experience with the severity of what's happening. And Ray and Dale really take him under the wing. They are brothers in arms, and yet they're big brothers in arms to him. And sort of for good and bad, they're mixed characters in many ways, where they do some good things and do some maybe unhelpful things. But mostly they're trying to take care of him. Mostly they're trying, they realize that if he is 18, he's a young 18. And when he finally does reveal his actual age to them, they're like, okay, well, we were pretty sure that you weren't exactly 18. We weren't, you know, positive that you're actually 14, 15 or whatever. So when these friends of his pass away, various experiences in the war, it's very hard on him. And Joe begins to go inward. He begins to close himself off. This is not uncommon for any of us, really. When we go through grief, that's a temptation, right? It's easy to say, well, this person has hurt me, or this person has let me down, or this person is no longer in my life for justifiable reasons. And that experience hurts, and therefore I'm gonna wall myself off as well. So Joe becomes very protective of his inner self, his inner core. I think the application here is for us is certainly there's a tendency to do this. And yet when we are hurt, when we are grieved, really a better way is to make ourselves available to people who love us and care for us, and keep those relationships alive that we can, and surround ourselves with a group of caring people who can help, buoy us through this difficult time.
More from our Reagan Forum with Marcus Brotherton after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now back to our Reagan Forum with Marcus Brotherton.
Now, clearly, war today is much different than it was in the 1940s. And, you know, you talked about, when you're talking about his mother and just a different generation, and, you could do things differently then that you did now. But when I think about a 14, 15-year-old today, you know, that boy is sitting on a couch or on his bed, in his bedroom, playing video games, you know, on social media, skateboarding with his friends, you know, going out for pizza. I can't imagine a 14, 15-year-old boy on a battlefield. Do you think a kid could survive war today like Joe was able to survive back then?
Fascinating question. So my wife and I have three children, and our middle child is a 14-year-old boy, Zach. So he just turned 14. And my wife read this manuscript in its preparation, and she was in tears and just saying, "Can you imagine Zach, our son, in that type of world?" And Heather Morris, who endorsed the book, who written Tattooist of Auschwitz, she had the same response. She said, my mother's heart broke for Joe. She said, "I fell in love with Joe as a mother, and I was imagining this, literally this child, go through those experiences." Your specific question, could a boy handle that these days? Certainly, I think there are robust elements of young people in the world today. Absolutely. I think the prayer here is that it would never again happen to any teenager. Let's keep teens out of war.
Yeah. So you talked about your wife tearing up when she was reading the section or chapter when he first kills his first person with a gun and then kills his first person by hand, really got to me. Now, he had a tumultuous four or so years in the military. Most of it was as a prisoner of war, horrible labor camps, starved, beaten, multiple times almost died. He came home from war with really bad PTSD, as one would, one could imagine. How did he get through that?
Yeah, these initial killings on his behalf come fairly early in the war, and yet they're far enough along where he understands the reality of what's happening. It's kill or be killed. And so I've got a job to do, and so I just need to steel myself. And, he's a runner for part of that time, and he's a machine gun loader for another part of that time. And so he's going, through the forest and through the jungle to these various locations, taking messages back and forth. He knows all the trails, and he knows where the snipers are. He knows that this is battle. Yes, absolutely. He goes through horrific times in the POW camps. And then, yes, he comes home and experiences this PTSD. Interesting enough, I did a book with Gary Sinise, who I know you know at the Reagan Foundation. Gary Sinise, tremendous man who works with veterans these days. He played Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, and now he's got the Gary Sinise Foundation, helping wounded veterans. So Gary and I, when we were working on his book, Grateful American, we had a very interesting discussion about PTSD. Mm-hmm. And Gary has this fairly emphatic theory that he doesn't believe in, and I say this very carefully and hear me out, he doesn't believe in PTSD. And I said, "Okay, so what does this mean? You don't believe in PTSD?" And he says, "Well, it's not a disorder." He said, "Absolutely, post-traumatic stress happens, but let's not call it a disorder. We take normal, everyday human beings we put them in this horrific situation, hey, you're going to respond to that. You're going to have post-traumatic stress. It's not a disorder. It's a normal reaction to what you went through. Mm-hmm. That's what Joe went through as well. He comes home and now he's got to just figure life out at home. Man, what is real life? What is this life like?
Not to get off topic, but Gary Sinise is a wonderful human being, and he also connected us to a speaker at one of our Veterans Day events that I think you also wrote a book with, and of course I'm blanking on his name, Brian. You wrote a book on his life in the war and came back with out all of his limbs, and then he became just this remarkable, I think he snowboards, and he, you know, just an incredible story.
Travis Mills, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Travis Mills, that's yes. So I'm going to read this next card because it comes from your book. At the start of part three of your book, that's written in Joe's voice, Joe says, every man buried under that soil is a hero. A man gives his life so others can be free. He's a hero. We forget that these days, we damn well do. Do you think this is one of the reasons why Joe, as an older man, did want to tell his story to remember the heroes, remember those that lost their lives?
Absolutely. When Joe comes home, he struggles with any number of jobs, eventually reenlists, he gets sent to Korea, gets shot in the stomach, comes home, struggles in a couple marriages, three marriages, struggles with anger, struggles with holding a job, sort of any number of things. Toward the end of his life, he comes out of all of this through any number of situations that really help facilitate his healing. And as part of that healing, Joe begins to give back in just remarkable ways. And he becomes a veteran spokesperson. And he goes around and tells his story to sort of any group who will listen, whether it's a school or a church or a community group or whatever. And this is part of his extended mission later in life, is shining the spotlight on veterans, on first responders, on people who are helping preserve this freedom. And that becomes a big part of his life.
In reading the book, I was just so surprised, again, because of how young he was, how he always seemed to be a step ahead. He always seemed to outsmart, outwit. I mean, the fact that when they were in boot camp doing sniper training and he had the highest score, and when he is had been in the prisoner of war camp for a while and he's not doing well at all and he thinks he's not going to survive, he gets this crazy idea that works. If I act like I'm going insane, they'll send me away and I can live. What gave him that idea? Can you talk through that part of his life?
Yeah, it's really a disturbing story, but it's fascinating in his ingenuity. Joe is a smart kid, even though he's only got the seventh grade education. You know, incidentally, after the war, he comes home and he does complete his GED. He does take some college classes. And those who knew him best say, yeah, Joe was brilliant. I mean, he could memorize just long poems and monologues that famous speakers had given, and he could sing sort of every word to La Marseillaise, and he knew different languages, and very unique, interesting, uneducated but brilliant man. And so his smarts, I think, really helped him live. His sense of humor sort of kept the sense of optimism alive in his life. And then this risk-taking element of him that sometimes borders on the extreme. This was one of the cases. So Joe is, he's actually moved around to several different POW camps during his time of captivity. Some of the camps are better than others. Now, they're all pretty bad. But within that, there are degrees of worseness, to use that word. One of the better places is Bilibid Prison in Manila. And Joe has been there. He knows they've got some medical supplies. They know that they've got a few American doctors who are also in captivity that are helping the various prisoners and whatnot. Anyway, so Joe is at Bilibid for a while, and then he's sent to this Nichols Field detail. And Nichols Field is one of the worst of the worst. It's really horrific. The prisoners are tasked with hard labor. They're moving. They're helping to build this airstrip for the enemy, and it's literally moving this hillside by hand, by pick and shovel and just carrying and railway cars and very, very difficult work. The pressure is on the guards and the camp commandant, and so they are putting that pressure on the prisoners to up the pace to complete this airstrip so enemy planes can land and, you know, further the battle effort. So it's a very, very difficult environment. Joe gets beaten one day for a fairly small infraction, and he knows he survives the beating, but he knows my time is limited. He's seen some executions at the camp. Joe is sick by then. He's a couple of years into it. He's got beriberi and scurvy and this persistent case of malaria and kind of any number of other things. His weight is down. Eventually he gets to like 6'4" and he's weighing 109 pounds. I mean, it's just sort of walking skeletons. So anyway, he's beaten and he's trying to heal. Unfortunately, there are a few kind guards, even in this horrific detail. One of the guards is a father himself. He takes pity on Joe and gets Joe put on a slightly easier job at Nichols Field just to help him heal, and also slips him some food every day for a little while, just helping Joe to build up some reserves. So Joe survives the beating. He does heal a little bit, but then he knows kind of big picture, hey, I'm not going to survive Nichols Field. What am I going to do? If I could only get sent back to Bilibid prison, well, conditions at Bilibid are a little bit better. And so Joe, he figures out this just horrific plan of feigning insanity. And the enemy guards, if a prisoner did go insane, insanity in that subculture was considered something to avoid and sort of be afraid of and oh, you know, gotta avoid him. So Joe has got one of his few possessions. He's got this spoon, this canteen spoon, and he spends any number of days. Anytime he goes to the latrine, there's a stone in the latrine, and he sharpens this spoon to a razor point. And then when the big day comes, he knows his act has got to be just completely convincing. Otherwise, they're going to kill him for sure. So he runs into the midst of guards, slicing his arm, takes the blood, smears it on his face, yelling that he's crazy, yelling insults at the Japanese soldiers. Sure enough, that's just enough to where they go, okay, this guy's nuts. They bind him, leave him out in the sun all day long, sort of hogtied in the dirt. And then at the day's end, he's marched back to the Passay school compound where the prisoners sleep. Unfortunately, at that point, he's put into what's called an ISO, which is this coffin-like box, very small quarters. You can't sit, you can't stand, you're forced into this fetal position, and they put him into this box for almost a week. There's slats in the box. He's not given any food, he's not given any water. Fortunately, it rains, and the rain keeps him alive. But literally in this box, Joe's going, I am nuts. I, you know, he starts to cackle and just, you know, I guess I'm dead because no one ever comes out of the ISO alive. During that time, there's a fascinating little story where he's not a religious man at all, but he does pray the words to this Methodist prayer, like, God have mercy on me. And that's when the rain comes, actually, which is a fascinating piece of that story. We don't know why, we don't know exactly what happened, but Joe is taken out of this ISO, thrown in the back of a truck, and he's sort of bounced along this road. He doesn't know where he's going. And when he wakes up, he sees the face of an American doctor. He's made it to the prison. He's made it back to Bilibid. His audacious plan worked.
And just to finish that idea off, I guess I was very surprised or caught unaware, you know, in reading your book and reading the stories about World War II and how barbaric they were in the Philippines and in all these different places, and reading the stories about, you know, how they were treated as prisoners, that this one hospital in the camp had American doctors and American nurses, and they were given, I mean, not a ton of food, but they were given food, and they nursed him back to life, and they let him rest and let him sleep. I didn't know that existed. How was that able to be?
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece of the story as well, that when the Americans and Filipino soldiers surrendered in 1942 under General Wainwright, there's any number of military branches that are part of that surrender. And so there are medics, there are surgeons, there are still a few nurses left in the Philippines. And within the camps, every once in a while, I mean, it's sort of one horrific story after another, but in the camps, every once in a while, there's this kind of strange story of mercy that does happen. Every once in a while, a letter could come through, or there were Red Cross boxes that, you know, made it through, usually late and usually not at all, but every once in a while it does happen. And sure enough, there's these American doctors, and they're still allowed to practice within certain regulations. From the Japanese perspective, it was, well, you know, we need our workforce working. So if a man's sick, then, you know, get him better so he can keep working. I think that's kind of the mindset there.
Got it. So after all of this, you know, he's almost dies a couple of times. He's a prisoner of war for a couple of years. As you said, 6'4", 110 pounds. He comes home. He has PTSD, or no D, but, you know, whatever it is. And yet he ends up enlisting afterwards in the Air Force and in the Marines. Why did he continue that as his career and job?
I think in Joe's mind, it was all he knew. It's difficult to say, and that was one of those questions that why we wish we had Joe here to really ask him, what was your motivation? Joe came back from the war again, you know, what are his skills? Seventh grade education. Well, I know how to load a machine gun. I know how to escape from the enemy, or at least stay alive. What can I do now back in America? Well, I'm going to reenlist.
So you may not know the answer to this question, but it kind of made me giggle. I read that he actually joined the Marines because they were going to let him play baseball. And I thought to myself, where did this kid even learn how to play baseball? Because, you know, with his upbringing and I know with his dad, he learned how to be a jockey. But, you know, where does even the itch to play baseball come from? I just found that really odd. I don't know if you came across anything in your research on him.
He's a big baseball fan. It's difficult to know as a child. I mean, I think baseball, if you have a wooden branch and some kind of thing you can make into a ball, the neighborhood kids are out playing baseball. It's the all-American sport. Sure. So yeah, he's quite a good ball player and joins the Marines yet to play on their baseball team. Korea happens. They come knocking on his door and say, sorry, we're sending overseas.
So not on purpose, but I've yet to ask a question, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but I've yet to ask a question about, is it Perpetua? Is that how you say her name? She's the thread throughout the whole book. This is the woman, or girl, that Joe Johnson meets when he's 14 and she's 13. They have just a month or two of connection, and then his thoughts of her and of reconnecting with her really keep him going throughout the whole book, throughout his whole life. I found it interesting that in his, you know, no fear, his, you know, I'm going to join the military at 14, I'm going to this, I'm going to that, that when he does come home, and they're writing letters, he has found her, and they're writing letters, and the letters stop. Now, this is way before he finds out why the letters stop. The letters stop. He doesn't go try and find her then. And I think I was really surprised by that. Did you learn anything in your research about why he didn't at that time?
Yeah, Perpetua is a fascinating thread in this book, and it's one of the pieces of the story that really drew me to Joe's story as a whole. And to explain what's happening there, before the war breaks out, Joe is in Manila. He's hanging out with all his buddies who are, again, much older than he are. And it's kind of this coarse, hyper-masculine culture. And within that culture, you know, how to explain this, sometimes soldiers go off and visit brothels. You know, for worse, that's what happens, particularly in overseas situations. So Joe is compelled to go visit this brothel where he meets this young girl who's working in the brothel, who's just a year younger than he is. And they do consummate the relationship once and only once, the first time he sees her. But then Joe begins to develop a true sense of empathy and I think a greater sense of true or noble masculinity. He begins to see this young woman for who she is. And he identifies with her plight. She's an orphan herself. And unfortunately, in that subculture, there just wasn't a whole lot of options for young girls who were, you know, trying to make their way in the world. And there's a book that talks about how just many of the women who worked in the brothels, they were motivated by one thing, and that was to keep eating, you know, to keep living. Mm-hmm. There's no other thing that we can do. Okay, so we got to work here, as horrible as that is. Anyway, so Joe develops this true friendship with her, and she develops this true friendship with him. He does learn eventually that she becomes pregnant, and there's this suspicion he has that, oh my goodness, maybe I'm the father. And that's kind of one of the questions that gets spiraled out as the book goes along. But Joe begins to care about her, and, you know, can we do something better for ourselves? It's not a case of him saving her, but it's she is saving him by giving him this sense of, now I can redeem myself. Now I can do the right thing. Let's help this person as she is helping me. So he actually helps her escape from the brothel, brings her to a convent where they're able to give her some refuge and shelter and sanctuary. And then Joe doesn't see her during the war years, but it's this memory of Perpetua and this hope that they can reunite at the end of the war. So your question is, he comes home to the States, they're writing letters, then the letters stop. Why doesn't he go back right then? That's a fascinating question. We can chalk it up to, it's not an easy matter to jump on a plane in that era, perhaps. We can chalk it up to, he is still healing himself. He's sort of just gotten out of the hospital himself. Perhaps he is worried at that point that, that, you know, her love for me is over. We've been writing like gangbusters, now her letters suddenly stop. Who exactly knows? I do know at that time and in that era, one of the fascinating dynamics of the men who came home and the families they had is that nobody really was talking about the war. It was all happy days. We've just won the war. And now we want to settle down and buy that refrigerator and buy that home and you know, create that baby boomer generation, right? Let's have some kids and start families and get on with our lives. We don't want to remember the horror. And it would be interesting to know if Joe was here today to really probe that question and say, what motivated you, you know, to leave that relationship for what it was?
Yeah, I mean, it really was a beautiful friendship and a beautiful love story. So you mentioned in the beginning of this that he passed away at the age of 91 in 2017. Of everything he went through, which is just each part of his life is more amazing than the next. In your opinion, what is the most amazing part of his life, or what do you think he would want people to most know about him?
Those latter years really are fascinating because he does realize his need, that he can't sort of continue on the way he's been going. He's filled with anger. He's filled with rage. His marriages aren't working. He's kind of a lousy father to the kids he does have in America. And it gets so bad at one point that he checks himself into what he calls a psych ward in Palo Alto. And Joe is only Joe can spit a story. He says, those doctors were really good. They really got a hold of my brain and straightened my butt out, something like that, right? And it was, they're teaching him coping mechanisms. They're teaching him about forgiveness. Now this is tricky, right? I mean, forgiveness is a tricky situation. We're sort of often encouraged these days that we need to forgive people who have harmed us. Well, could Joe do that? I think at least he could extend forgiveness. I mean, the enemy, the former enemy wasn't sort of going to come to him and apologize. It wasn't going to be a sort of a 100% reconciliation there. But at least he could, as he puts it, set that burden down. He says, I wasn't going to continually hate the enemy in my mind. You know, there are reasons why they did what they did. I'm not going to hold it against him. I'm not going to walk around for the rest of my life filled with rage. And Joe talks about how he was going to set that burden down and set it down again and set it down and keep setting it down. Like it was more than a one-time experience of forgiveness where he had to really remind himself, okay, yes, life is continuing forward. I think fascinatingly, at the very end of his life, Joe has never been a religious person at all. I mean, other than this Methodist prayer, he's never gone to church, never anything. And one day he's 90 years old. He's watching TV, flipping channels, comes across this television preacher and begins to listen to him. And we learn later that it's actually Dr. Charles Stanley, who's kind of a famous preacher in Atlanta area. And Joe makes this 11th hour decision to kind of get his life right with God. He says, you know, the grace of God is wide and deep, and it could even extend to a person like me. Fantastic. So he makes this 11th hour conversion, dedicating his life to God. And those who knew him best say, wow, it worked. I mean, his life, even in that last year of his life, he was a changed man. And Joe begins to look back on his life, and he comes to this conclusion that even before his 11th hour conversion experience, God had been working in his life anyway, even though he was kind of far from God. Fascinating concept. Can God work in people's lives even when they don't want anything to do with them? In Joe's case, he would say yes. So Joe talks about how he had really become a kinder person and a caring person. And he wasn't sort of trying to get something from somebody. He was trying to give back.
A remarkable human being. My last question is just me being curious. A lot of what you've written or co-authored, for people who don't know, have been turned into movies and shows like The Pacific and Bands of Brothers. And I'm just wondering if any of your more recent books might be turned into something we can watch as well.
Sure. And just to clarify there, the Pacific had been made, and then we talked to the veterans after that. So it was kind of a 1-2 process there. I edited a number of work as a co-writer and co-author a lot at the same time. I edited a book called Devotion by Adam Makos. It is just getting turned into a movie. It's going to be out this October. Keep that on your radar to watch.
Great. So for anyone watching at home, recommend the book any more than I can tell you. It is a fabulous read. Joe Johnson's life is incredible, and Marcus did just a tremendous job sharing the story in such an engaging way. As he said earlier in the program, we have to remember our veterans. We have to listen to their stories. We cannot forget them. So let's not forget Joe Johnson and all of his fellow soldiers that fought with him and were prisoners of war with him. I want to thank you for your time, Marcus. We really greatly appreciate it, especially on this Memorial Day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Signed copies of A Bright and Blinding Sun can be purchased through the Reagan Library Museum Store. Every purchase you make from our catalog, website, or museum store is a critical component to our success. In short, your purchase supports our efforts to extend the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. Purchases can be made at reaganlibrary.com/store. To find a listing of all upcoming events, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening, and God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast, featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.